Hello, this is Frank, and this is my show. I call this Santa Barbara Cyclist. Welcome. And today, what a special treat I have for you, Roger Geller, City of Portland, Oregon's bicycle coordinator, long-term in that role. Went to visit him just last week, and I brought friends from the Santa Barbara Bike Coalition along, too. We were a party of 11. And late on a Friday afternoon, Roger met with us at Portland City Hall and patiently answered all of our questions. Maybe I was so excited. Maybe that's the reason why it took me a minute or two to turn on the recorder. But I caught most of it, and what a tour de force of bicycle infrastructure and how it happened in a platinum-level city. Let's listen.
We've had a neighborhood traffic calming program that goes back to the 1980s, and there were very complicated formulas that we employed about diversion and how much traffic other streets could take, and it was based on percentage increase and they produce these interesting curves of how much volume you could increase. And we've simplified it by just saying that, up to 1,000 cars, total volume of 1,000 cars are acceptable on other local streets.
Additional?
Total.
Okay.
Total. So the total, you could go up to 1,000 cars, not additional, but so if you're at 300, if another 700 cars go on your street. And obviously that's a big impact on the street.
Yeah.
But our rationale was that we're calling for neighborhood greenways to be developed so that they have no more than 1,000 cars. Right? We want them to have 1,000 cars or fewer, ideally.
Yeah.
And so if that's the conditions that we're willing to accept on a neighborhood greenway, then it seems like that's also a reasonable condition to have on other local streets, especially when we're trying to create this network of bikeways. So we're basically saying that this street is so important in our transportation system that we're willing to slightly degrade what's happening on these other streets, with the hope, obviously, that the people driving the cars won't all start driving on the other street, right? Instead, the people driving the cars will get on bikes.
Yeah.
That's the policy. So that's where we're going.
And what policy document do you have that house under? Is that your circulation element?
No, it's so it is a report that we did. It's called Neighborhood Greenway Assessment Report.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked at how our neighborhood greenways were performing, existing neighborhood greenways, and then just set guidelines for how we want them to operate. And within that, we have it identified what we're willing to accept. In terms of diversion onto other streets, we took that to City Council and had that adopted by City Council.
Okay.
So it's not a formal policy in our comp plan, although our policies it's consistent with our comp plan policies, which mm-hmm. call for, we have a green transportation hierarchy that's been adopted in our plans, which basically we say we're going to plan and develop our transportation system so that we prioritize walking, then biking, then transit, then shared vehicles, or multi-passenger vehicles, then, electric vehicles, other low-emission vehicles, then horses, then donkeys. So at some point we get to single-occupancy vehicle cars. So basically, by policy, we put cars at the bottom. We have a policy that says that it's our policy to make bicycling more attractive than driving. So that's official adopted city policy in our comp plan. And then we have a policy that talks about developing a bicycle network that's safe and comfortable for people of all ages and abilities. So these guidelines that we've adopted for our neighborhood greenways are consistent with all of that.
I feel like I'm visiting, some other planet, Roger, and more intelligent species.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, we're not at all satisfied with where we're at. We feel like we've got some good policies on the books, and we've got some good tools, but it's still... It's easier than it's been in some ways, but we're also trying to do more. So,
mm-hmm.
But neighborhood greenways are generally very well received.
Yeah. Great.
As you were describing that, Roger, so you're trying to do more. Does that generate or cause a continuous some degree of resistance with what you're doing. Is it different from what it was, say, 10 years ago, or when you were like our size or our sophistication, let's say, or when you were doing this in an earlier time?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we still meet resistance, but it's gotten a lot easier. So I guess I've thought about this. The analogy I use is that everybody goes after the low hanging fruit,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. And so we're still going after the low hanging fruit. What's low hanging now is a lot higher on the tree, though, because we've plucked off all the lower ones.
That's good.
But we've also gotten taller. So, and I think the taller part is that there's greater acceptance among Portlanders of the benefits of bicycling. There's more and more people bicycling. It's not just 20-year-old men anymore, which is what it overwhelmingly had been and is in most places in the U.S. And so it's now much easier for us generally to go in and remove on-street parking. It's much easier for us to go in and do road diets and remove travel lanes. You've seen NATO Parkway.
Yes.
That was really interesting because that was it was started by advocates. It was a Better Block project, Better Block PDX project. And they worked with the city to create it in its first iterations, first years. This is the third year it's been in effect. And so it was helpful that citizens started it and basically just came to us and said, can we do this? And so the first year we worked with them and they basically set out some orange cones in the roadway for a week or two. And the rationale, and they really emphasized the pedestrian benefits of it as much as the biking benefits and just the creation of a good space. The park that it's adjacent to, in a certain way, it serves as our city fairgrounds. There's big festivals in that park throughout the year. And there's one in particular in June called the Rose Festival that just fills up the whole park with, booths and rides and there's no sidewalk along that western edge of the park. And so people would just walk out into the street. And so we convinced, the advocates convinced the city to, create basically a shared bicycle and pedestrian space. The second year, other festivals that were operating in Waterfront Park wanted to do it. And so they said, hey, can we do it for our festival too? And so it was longer.
Still the orange cones?
Still the orange cones.
Okay.
Slightly skinnier orange cones. And then we went to council last year and said, hey, let's do this every year. It's a seasonal thing. So it's called Better NATO. It's called Seasonal Better NATO. So we got funding from council to set up those delineator posts that you see out there today seasonally. So I think it's May through the end of September. So they're going to disappear in 8 days. But now it's a completely city-run project, and we fully anticipate that before too long it'll just become permanent. Our Parks Bureau really doesn't – they really like it because they don't want people riding in Waterfront Park. We get a lot of complaints. That corridor, that NATO Park corridor is probably our second or third busiest bike corridor in the city. It's about 6,000 daily bike trips. So, removing lanes, so that was not that difficult to remove the lanes. It's been criticized quite a bit. But we're doing a lot of projects around town where we are removing travel lanes, we are removing parking, and we're generally not getting a ton of opposition to it. We do parking demand studies, and so, we often are able to demonstrate that the entire parking demand for one street can be accommodated on just one side of the street. We're doing a lot of road diets. We're a Vision Zero city, so we've officially adopted Vision Zero as city policy. And so when you see it through that lens, it makes it a lot easier to create safer conditions for biking and walking. And so we do a lot of road diets. And again, with the road diets, we're able to demonstrate that, not only does it reduce crashes, but it doesn't, up to certain volumes, of course, it doesn't really affect the flow of traffic, mm-hmm. and it's yeah. better in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that people are accustomed to those arguments. And so we're not getting as much pushback as we got, 25 years ago when we would, take two 14-foot wide travel lanes, narrow them up to 11 feet, get like a 5.5-foot bike lane out of that, and people would go crazy. Still two travel lanes. We just added a bike lane, but people would be very upset about that. So that's, in some ways how we've gotten taller.
And for us, there's probably no shortcuts for us. We're just going to have to take the time and listen to the criticisms and demonstrate that it's good throughput and people can still park their cars. There's no shortcuts to like reducing that bike lash concept.
Yeah.
It helps, though, to have a city in the United States other than Copenhagen or somewhere where you can hold it up to city council members or members of the board of supervisors, and you can say, hey, this is not some foreign concept that we're trying to put on top of you. These are things that have been tried and true in another city within the, not necessarily in California, but in Oregon.
Actually, it's been done in Davis.
But
there's so many cities right now that are doing it across the U.S.
Although
I think that's our shortcut is we're catching a moving train that wasn't there, and we made it.
We've also adopted. I think the other thing that's been helpful for us is we've adopted 10-foot as our standard travel lane width.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know when you're fighting over every inch, sometimes that makes a big difference.
Old Town Goleta.
Because the owner does. One of the interesting things, do you know Drew Van Hinkle?
Yeah.
Nelson Nygaard? We met with her earlier today, and she was sharing that on your bicycle, or on your neighborhood greenways, that the chicanes that are retaining water, the like bioswale chicanes, were funded with a sort of water retention funding source.
Yeah.
Do you know how they're doing that? Because we have a series of creeks that run through our city, and I think it would be great to bring on the Creeks Department as a partner, and you know,
especially because they have money,
and they have funding. But also, I mean, it's I think it's a more conservative kind of crowd that runs the Creek Council and the Creek Department, and it's unfortunate our transportation department is running into issues working with the Parks Department and with the Creeks.
Yeah.
So if there was a way that we could partner on a project, that could pay a lot of dividends in the future.
The bioswales, they're not really, they don't really operate as chicanes. They don't stand out any further from the roadway than a parked car on the residential streets. I mean, maybe they have some traffic calming features. If we can use them as semi-diverters, then that's, a very strong function for them. But we did work with our Bureau of Environmental Services. So we're under basically a federal mandate to clean up the Willamette River, to not let household runoff to go into the river. And so we have a combined sewer system. So when it rains, the combined sewers will overflow into the Willamette. And we've done a lot of pipe work. We've built some big pipes to retain it down close to the river. But then we also have issues in our neighborhoods where we have very small sanitary sewer pipes that tend to back up if there's a lot of water that's getting into the surface stormwater system. So we have a very strong program to retain surface stormwater as much as possible, and that's what the bioswales do. And so a former mayor recognized that, if we're doing work, if we're putting curb extensions on roadways, if we're putting in semi-diverters that are, curb extensions, that maybe we have an opportunity to use some of the Bureau of Environmental Services money, and they operate, they're a utility, a city utility, and they're flush. They've got a lot of money, and we've never had money before. We do have some, but we've never had money before, and so we look for ways to work together. And so we only put those in at locations where there was a need for surface stormwater retention, typically in areas where the sanitary sewer pipe diameters were very narrow. And so we just kind of looked for, there's streets where we want to develop neighborhood greenways, there's streets where we want to retain surface stormwater. Let's see if we can find locations that benefit us both. And so that was what we did on in certain neighborhoods. It's not, we couldn't do it everywhere, but in a lot of areas we were able to do it. Yeah.
Cool.
And then certain people, there was a time within that program in environmental services where basically they felt like every ounce of stormwater that was retained and didn't get into the system was a benefit overall. And so under that thinking, you could put a surface storm, you could put a bioswale anywhere, but they became more focused in their approach, and so they stopped doing them everywhere.
I see. Yeah, we're unfortunately not really getting a lot of rain.
Yeah.
But maybe there are other sort of design devices that function in that way.
Do you have flooding in Santa Barbara?
We do, rain, actually. That's
like,
kind of
like flash flooding?
Oh, yeah. Our streets are not built to handle.
So you might want to talk to Boulder, because Boulder, Colorado built a very extensive network of pathways with their water, I can't remember what they call their
the agency. Yeah, Will Tour, right? He was...
I can't remember who,
Mayor, transportation commissioner at the time they really started to make that... I think that Colorado did a better job of nuancing their state law versus how California did for flood control agencies and transportation easements. I think we just haven't done as good of a job of using these flood control routes.
Right, and that's what Boulder did, and they built a lot of pathways along those. And
We've been able to do that for like Maria Ignacio Creek and the Overton Trail.
Yeah.
We're both done on those kinds of easements.
But then San Jose Creek, the most recent one, wasn't.
Yeah. And it's that one has other issues with the railroad.
We have an example of a rail to trail with Union Pacific. It's the Steel Bridge.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Of course, we were on there today. And another idea is we're moving around the city, seeing a lot of different kinds of bike lanes, Roger. And this morning, where were we? Over by the Oregon Environmental Center, we're seeing, a sidewalk, bike lane, then parking. Is that the standard, or could you speak to the evolution of your thinking on separated bike lanes?
Yeah, so we've had a network in place for a long time. So we had a bike plan back in 96, and at the time, all that we knew and all of the advocates sitting around the table knew was the 5-foot bike lane, right? Let's get a 5-foot bike lane on our arterial streets and everything will be great.
Yeah.
And obviously our thinking has changed, and so we now have a director of our agency, Leah Tree, who has called for protected bike lanes to be the standard on projects. And so that's made a huge difference, that she's given us all a directive saying that when you're thinking about separated facilities, that the protected bike lane is where you start. So in the past, as city staff, our approach to projects would always be, okay, we can get a 5-foot bike lane. Can we do more? And it's hard to do more. There's trade-offs. You're taking space away from something else to get the width that you need for a protected lane, typically, and it costs more. And so we'd often abandon the idea. Maybe we'd get a 6-foot bike lane, maybe we'd get a buffered bike lane, but rarely would we get to a protected bike lane. And now with this directive, our starting point is the protected bike lane, and if we do less, we have to have a really good reason why. And so what that's done is it's kept us all at the table, working with our community partners, working with the engineers, working with the project managers to make it work. And we're getting better at it. In fact, we're developing an in-house protected bike lane design guide that's just specific to Portland. As we develop more and more bike facilities, and as we're retrofitting a lot of our old stuff, we're looking at how do we do protected lanes. And that's what's resulting in the parking removal, travel lane removal. Most of them are going to be retrofits. Mm-hmm. Many of them will probably be parking protected so that we can preserve as much parking as possible. But, that's the direction in which we're heading, is all protected lanes.
Mm-hmm. It would be nice if we could, again, leap to that as best practice. But it seems like we're all condemned to, start with that 5-foot bike lane and then buffer it, and that same torturous path to getting there. Any advice other than we can document what you've done and take it home and try to sell it?
Well, I think there's some good research on protected lanes. So there's a document that was done by researchers at Portland State University working with People for Bikes. Mm-hmm. It's called Lessons from the Green Lanes. Have you heard about that one? So that's a pretty nice study that takes a look at the safety operation of protected lanes, but also the willingness of average people to use them. And so there was some really good data about people's willingness to use protected lanes. So that's probably the most recent research that I'm aware of. But I think there's also a lot of examples from other cities. Mm-hmm. People are building protected lanes left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know that it's that you have to repeat everybody's past, because I think there's a lot more information available about the benefits of protected lanes to achieve stated city goals, mm-hmm. and that they probably do a better job than a standard 5-foot bike lane.
Yeah, we have two moving forward in the region, and I definitely hope that we can kind of pivot from those two to help make that our sort of bike lane golden standard, and we're planning to do programming and celebrate them and hopefully like just make it sort of like a landmark occasion in the bicycle story of our community. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to your Bike Advisory Commission,
yeah.
Council, and how they sort of, what role they have played in the development of your policies and
sure.
what they're doing now. Yeah.
Yeah, so the bike we have a Bicycle Advisory Committee. It's been around since probably the 70s in one form or another. And it's a 20-member committee. They're advisory to the city, and they meet monthly. And I think probably the biggest role, probably where they've had the most impact, has been advising on policies and then on project designs. So we recently went through a pretty big exercise to update our comprehensive plan, and they were pretty active in that and, you know, pushing us for the strongest possible policies. And then recently, in fact, we're still in the process of updating elements of our comp plan. We have a goal to achieve a 25% bicycle mode split in the city. And we had proposed, based on some modeling, to reduce that to 15%. And they would have none of that. And they sent us a letter and said, we'll have none of that. And
really?
And,
wow.
Right? And,
is that because of the rise in like autonomous car sharing?
The drop?
Yeah.
Oh, we had some modeling, and I don't think it was very good modeling, but that the live-work balance was not strong enough to support 25% for bicycle commute trips.
I see. So many people are coming from outside the city that they...
Not even so much outside the city. I mean, yeah, but we don't even care about outside the city, because we're just the city of Portland. Mm-hmm. So even for our own residents, the downtown is the main employment hub. There's a couple of other employment hubs scattered throughout the city. But some of our planned town centers, you know, places within the city of Portland where we expected lots of employment to locate, it hasn't happened yet. And so, and those tend to be more on the outskirts, and those areas are also growing rapidly. So with more population moving further away from the central city, it's making the commute trip longer for more people. And so the modeling showed that, you know, at best we'll get to 15%. Again, it wasn't necessarily the best modeling, and it made some assumptions that... anyhow, the committee looked at that and said, yeah, we think it's still important to maintain an aspirational 25% mode split. So they weighed in on that. And then, like I said, they weighed in very much so on design. And so we bring a lot of projects to them and ask them what they think about the design, and they will always advocate for better designs, and they'll have good rationales for why. And we're updating our bicycle parking code. They're weighing in on that. And individual members will also serve on citizen advisory committees, two different projects. So, sometimes that how active the bicycle advisory committee is outside of their monthly meeting ebbs and flows. Right now we've got a pretty active bunch. So there's members that are serving on our off-road development of our off-road bicycle master plan, our plans for a major arterial, our plans for amending our bicycle parking code. So, both through monthly meeting and official communications with the city, as well as their participation on their committees, is how they're having influence.
City support their advisory committee? They provide staff?
And yes.
Yeah. And is that in addition to a transportation circulation committee, or is that...
No, we have kind of four main committees that advise the Office of Transportation: Bicycle Advisory Committee, a Pedestrian Advisory Committee, and a Freight Committee. Hmm. And then we also have a Budget Advisory Committee that makes decisions, you know, that helps the Bureau make decisions on how to allocate our funding. At the moment, we also have a local gas tax, a local 10-cent gas tax that is funding safety and maintenance projects for the next 4 years. So it's a 4-year local gas tax that sunsets, and we have a committee that's advising us on that kind of project delivery as well.
Roger, and I go in a different direction altogether, out of left field. You've been in your role for many years.
Yeah.
And that inspires as well your success, your being in that role for such a long time. Maybe some skills or talents that you brought to your role that have led to your long-term success here, that would inspire us.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of people who've been here for a long time and in good positions. So a lot of our traffic engineers have been here for a long time. They all ride bikes. A lot of our planners have been here for a long time, and project managers, they all ride bikes. And then we happen to have just really excellent agency leadership and senior management.
Can I interrupt to say we all ride bikes too.
Yeah.
But it's not working the same for us. And I just wonder your ability to work with different agencies or different parts of the city, you bring skills to that.
Yeah. So I think that, I think it's been some of the skills that I've brought have just been really good analysis, for example. So, we often say build it and they will come, but you have to demonstrate that indeed they are coming. In the early days, we developed a very simple graph based on bicycle counts, based on one day's of bicycle counts on, at the time, our four central city bicycle-friendly bridges. Mm-hmm. And what we showed is that, based on the counts of those bridges, that as the miles of bikeways increased, so did the bike traffic on those bridges. Because we'd get criticism in the early days from editorial boards, and our elected officials have got to have, as supportive as elected officials can be, and it looks like you've got a very supportive elected official here, they still, not everybody is supportive, and you elected officials need data. Need a talking point upon which they can hang their hat. Mm. And so I think it's been very important to provide, those talking points that, why are you wasting this money? Nobody bikes. Well, actually, the more money we spend, the more people bike. Well, you're spending too much money. Well, actually, this is our budget and, this is about how much we're spending on bikes. Well, congestion's awful. It's not working. Well, of the 55,000 people that moved here of the 55,000 new commuters that we've had since the year 2000, more than a third of them are biking to work.
Wow.
And so just being able to, display that and, talk about that, I think it's been helpful to provide those kind of talking points that,
Builds political support.
Yeah, it builds political support. It quiets the kind of blind criticism or uninformed criticism. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of knee jerk often.
Mm-hmm.
And it's won allies. I mean, there's people now who were very skeptical of our efforts who are now, for example, on our planning commission and are among the strongest advocates that we have in the area for biking. And then I think just being able to identify for our traffic engineers. We have a very collegial environment here at PBOT. And so, and obviously when we're working on projects, we form teams that bring people from different disciplines. And, just being able to demonstrate that there are effective ways to do things, even though we've never done them before, to show traffic engineers that there's a way to do these things that makes sense. And initially all the examples, of course, were from, the Netherlands or Germany or Denmark, but increasingly we're seeing examples in our own city as well as in cities across North America. And so I think just bringing those to people's attention. I think one thing about this field is that it's never bicycle traffic engineering. It's not cut and dried. And things are evolving rapidly. And we're finding that each year we're being pressed to do things that we had never done before in pursuit of our very strong policy goals. And I've often been a conduit for that information, say, hey, this looks like something that could work. And, let's see if we can figure out how to make this work in our, U.S. context, even though it's a design from somewhere else. And, and actually FHWA has been really good in recent years, and they've been advocating a lot of very progressive designs and policies. They put out their separated bike lane planning and design guide. And if you want to play a fun drinking game, just have somebody read it, and every time the word flexible shows up in that guide, you know, take a shot of something, because you know, they're just been the FHWA has been advocating a lot of flexibility and approach to bikeway design. And so, you know, just pointing things like that out to your city traffic engineer says, hey, the feds are telling us to be flexible. You know, let's figure out how to do this. And it's helped that, you know, the people here are, you know, like I said, we've had good leadership and people have been very willing to try new things. And so, you know, my role has just been to, you know, to push them and help introduce new designs and then demonstrate that it's working. I think the other thing that we're, you know, I've been effective has been in planning to help develop the bike plan that we have to work from, and then policies. So policies are, you know, can often be dead boring, and you know, nobody likes to get involved with it, but it's the foundation for everything else that you do. So I've been very focused. Whenever we're updating our policies, I've been very focused on that, and I think we have very strong policies now. That when somebody says, no, I don't want to do that because I don't think it's going to work, it's harder for them to say that when your policies say, well, we have to achieve a 25% bicycle mode split. We're supposed to make bicycling more attractive than driving. And it says that we have to make things safe and comfortable for people of all ages and abilities. So, and here's what, you know, international best practice is. And so,
how we're able to make a strong case.
Yeah, yeah, making a strong case. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So all that is interesting, and I wonder, how do you create numeric goals? Like you talked about greenways. How do you say there's X number of greenways we want to build? And I know you talked about by attrition not allowing non-greenways or non-friendly streets, but how do you set goals that are far enough ahead yet still attainable?
In 2010, we adopted a new bicycle plan that laid out a network. So that was key. When we started developing the plan, we had 30 miles of neighborhood greenways. And we'd had 30 miles for quite some time. We'd been really focused on bike lanes for quite a while and hadn't really expanded neighborhood greenways. In the course of planning, developing this new plan, we recognized that we needed to build a constituency. And to build a constituency, we had to get more people riding. And we felt that the easiest way and the quickest way to get more people biking was to develop a more developed network of neighborhood greenways. And so we laid that all out in the plan. And we laid that all out in our implementation strategy, that we would focus first on neighborhood greenways. And then it's just a matter of getting the funding. And so for a while, we were committed to developing from the level of the mayor. We had a very bike-friendly, you know, bicycle transportation-friendly mayor, Sam Adams. Mm-hmm. He said, okay, we're going to develop 15 miles of neighborhood greenways a year. And we're going to provide funding for it. And so staff, go.
So did he pick that number because he felt like he could find funding for 15 miles worth, or did he just pick 15 miles because it seemed like a good multiplier from the current number?
I think it was, it was based on some internal discussions, and, I think that was, you know, it was also a capacity issue. You know, what can staff handle over the course of a year? And so it seemed like, you know, that was a little bit of a reach, but achievable. And so... And I think we identified those corridors that we thought were most ready to go. And, you know, for the first year, it was about 15 miles. So
to put that in perspective, how many miles of roadways does Portland have?
I think we have like 2,600 centerline miles of roadways, something like that. Our bikeway network is about 370 miles of centerline, including off-street paths, neighborhood greenways, and... you know, any kind of bike lane, and we've got another 70 miles currently funded, more than 70 miles funded. We've got a project in our central city that's funded for about $8 million, but we haven't specifically identified the corridors that we'll develop yet. That's going to be part of the plan. So about a quarter of our system is neighborhood greenways, about a quarter of our system is off-street paths, and about a half of our system is, you know, some kind of a bike lane. Most of those are standard bike lanes, but increasingly... buffered and protected bike lanes as well.
How far have you gone through that master plan from 2010?
Not far enough.
Was it a 10-year plan or 8-year plan?
20-year plan.
20-year plan.
A 20-year, $600 million plan. We identified a total of about 950 miles of centerline miles of bikeways to be developed in the city. Right now, we're funded up to about 440 miles. But even so, and we've got more money coming in. So we recently passed at the state level a transportation funding bill that is going to bring us a bunch of money. We've got a pretty good pool of transportation system development funds available to us. And we've got this 10-cent local gas tax that is providing us with funding for safety and maintenance projects. Many of the safety projects are bikeways. And we're about to go after, we're getting ready for a regional bond measure that would focus on kind of a balance package. But we're looking for somewhere in the neighborhood across the region of $300 to $600 million for active transportation projects, so bike and ped projects. So, you know, right now we've got about $95 million identified for the next few years anyhow, not counting money that's already been allocated, and also not counting additional grant money that will come in from the feds. It's just part of regular grant funding cycles. And then we're looking at this bond measure as well. So we're actually kind of flush right now in ways that's stretching our capacity. We've built our system on, chewing gum and shoelaces, really, with the occasional federal grant. And this is the first time I started here in 94 when we had money. What felt like plenty of money, because at the time we were just striping 8-inch bike lanes everywhere. And we had plenty of money for that. And now we've got more money than we've got to gear up to be able to handle it. We don't quite have the capacity, engineering or the project management capacity quite yet, but we're hiring right now.
I hope to have that problem with our city.
I know. We've never this is a pretty delightful problem to have right now. We've never had this problem before, but we're also, because we're building, because our focus is more on protected bikeways, the projects are costing a lot more. So we're staying within the right of way, but we're going outside of the curbs. And so that just, that multiplies your cost significantly when you start doing that. But on a lot of projects, we just hope to be able to retrofit. We could very well be a city of delineator posts for quite a while. So I think our motto is, get the space, yeah. Right? Once you get the space, even if it's ugly for a little while, and we also use self-watering planters in some areas, so we're trying to make it not ugly, but we just want to get the space first, make it functional, and then we think that with that function will come a larger constituency of people that will ask us to make it nicer.
Quick technical question. So you have the 25% goal. Is that commute based on like the census, the community survey question, or?
Yeah, so we have a climate action plan for the city and the county that calls for a 25% bicycle commute mode split. Our comp plan right now is also calling for a 25% commute bike mode split in service to getting our auto mode split down to 30%. So we want to get our auto mode split, commute split down to 30%. The bike plan calls for a 25% all trip mode split for bikes.
Okay.
And we think that's in many ways easier to achieve than a commute trip. Because whereas, people might be going from their home to work, at their home, everything else that they do is probably a lot closer. So the trips are probably a lot shorter. So we feel like that is in some ways easier to achieve than the commute trip. But what we're measuring right now is a commute trip.
That leads into my next question about bike share and where you see the value of bike share in terms of how much is that helping commute trips versus other utilitarian trips versus residents versus visitors.
Yeah.
Are you starting to see some kind of results from that?
We are, and I wish I could retain the numbers on that better. We do have a nice presentation about bike share on our website. It's on the Bicycle Advisory Committee website. But we're seeing a lot of the use is from local residents.
Cool.
So we know that from the zip codes that because the people who are using the system, they have to provide, information about, credit card and what's your zip code. So we know that most of the people that are using it are local.
Roger, do you ever dream of like a winter vacation in Santa Barbara?
I've been to Santa Barbara.
Yeah?
Yeah. I passed through Santa Barbara only once with my kids a couple of years ago when we were looking at colleges.
You're due for another visit.
I'm due for another visit, yeah, probably.
What about February? it ought to be real good for them to get out and come see us.
Yeah?
Anytime.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's a beautiful city.
In fact, I wonder if it's rather even feasible if we could get Roger, Rob, who are somewhat comparable in different size cities, to have some sort of meeting, conversation, comparison of notes. Might be enlightening. Yeah.
Is Santa Barbara a member of NACTO?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, that would be a really good thing to do. NACTO has been a great resource. The kind of thing I assume Rob is city staff working on.
I know they reference the design manual or the NACTO guide.
Yeah, NACTO guide.
That I don't know
which is which I've been thinking about because of the waterfront protected bike lane. Your bollards are really close together, and we wrote it yesterday morning.
Yeah.
And we've been talking with our traffic engineer, who's talking about putting them 30 feet apart on our protected lane because that's the rate at which a car would pass one each second.
That's right.
But
at 30 miles an hour, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
the closer together feels better for the user.
Exactly.
Feels more protected.
Yeah, we've noticed that, and that's what we're putting in our guide, that the that in creating comfortable conditions, it should the placement of the of those should be not from the car driver's perspective, but from the bicycle rider's perspective.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, because I think it was a traffic engineer in Chicago that came up with that spacing,
mm-hmm.
which at the time I thought, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Not having really been in many of those facilities that have delineators. But then when you're in one, you especially think, oh, yeah, this is nicer the closer it is.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt when we went through the one yesterday. I was like, this is what we need to ask for.
Yeah, it creates more of a solid wall feeling, even though they're not very solid. But yeah, but anyhow, I'd encourage, you know, membership in NACTO because, you know, it's just very easy then to, there's a listserv, or at least an email list, that it's just very easy to reach out to peers in other cities and, you know, get information. I use it all the time. Hey, we're having a design issue here. Has anyone done this? And so that's a good resource. And then, you know, just going to the NACTO has an annual conference now, the Designing Cities Conference. This year it's in Chicago, end of October, beginning of November. And, you know, that is a very good conference for sharing information with peers across North America. Yeah.
I have a quick question about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're always looking at Portland. I'm like, wow, Portland. Where are you looking? We're like, wow.
Yeah, no, I'm looking. I mean, a lot of cities are doing really good things. So Chicago's doing good stuff. San Francisco is doing some good stuff. Vancouver, BC is doing some really good work. Calgary is doing some really nice designs. Seattle is doing some nice designs. Mm. Those are some of the cities that I've been focused on later where they've got just really experienced designers and engineers that are, and they're implementing a lot right now. And so they're gaining a lot of experience. Who else have I talked? Salt Lake City's doing some nice stuff. Austin, Texas. You know, in terms of network planning, I think Davis did a really good job in terms of planning things. Boulder's got some really nice facilities. But I think, you know, mostly we're looking for advice on protected lanes and, you know, how just dealing with intersections and, you know, that's the biggest, you know, I think that's one of the biggest challenges right now is just how do you design, what's a good intersection design for protected bikeways? And there's a study, there's a $250,000 study that Portland State University is doing right now, and they'll be reporting on it a little bit at NACTO. To look at, you know, what is the context for using for different design intersection design treatments with protected bike lanes, and then what are the designs that seem to work the best? And so, that's a body of work that'll probably be they're supposed to be done with that study. I think a year, maybe next April, and what feels most comfortable to people. So that's all part of the study that they're looking at. I think Cambridge, Massachusetts, I believe, is doing some nice work as well. You know, and I think what Portland's strength has been, even though our system hasn't been, you know, we haven't had the greatest designs, although they're now really getting a lot better, we've had a network. So Portland's had a network that's been very effective, so that if you're, you know, just moderately traffic tolerant as a cyclist, you could bike anywhere and be on an established bikeway. So I think that's been Portland's strength, is the network. One of the things Vision Zero is telling us, and we just got a state law passed that allows us to reduce travel speeds to 20 miles per hour in all of our residential districts.
Nice.
And this is true across the state. And so in residence districts, I think is what the law says, you can bring the speed down to 20 miles per hour. But even without that, we've had generally small arterials, especially in the inner city, with relatively low speeds. And our downtown has been, you know, a low-speed environment. So our short blocks, block every 250 feet, with signals on every block in the downtown, we progress our downtown speeds at 12 to 15 miles per hour, depending on time of day. And so it's always been the most, downtowns are always, for many jurisdictions, the most difficult nut to crack in terms of finding the space to provide bikeways. But our downtown is operated as a fairly comfortable shared space environment because of the low speeds. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's been key for our success, is that because we've done very little in the downtown up until recently, but people who are comfortable on 5-foot bike lanes, many of them were also comfortable in a shared lane when the speeds are 12 miles an hour. And not many cities have that. So I think we've been fortunate. You know, I think we've benefited from things that, you know, trying to create people-friendly spaces that didn't necessarily have an eye on bikes. So, you know, just anything that you can do to get your speeds down is just a huge benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. An interesting experience riding today next to one of the protected bike lanes with the planters, just seeing a cyclist who's going faster, you know, take the lane as opposed to the protected way. And it's like, oh, yeah, because everywhere I've had to take the lane, even on the bike share bikes, it's felt comfortable because the speeds are slow enough in this down in the core downtown.
Yeah.
And the drivers are surprisingly polite and waiting for you or letting you in.
I've heard that.
Amazing.
I've heard that's people's perception.
I haven't really gone into aggressive.
We live in the city where LA people go to vacation. You can expect more flack.
They're bringing their driving habits with them.
Wait, I don't think that's fair. I think there are a lot of Santa
Barbara's. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of
Portlanders there. I just like to blame it.
It also goes along with, though, when there are more cyclists out there on the road.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a unique thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's been some studies about that. Yeah.
Was that a conscious shift to time the signals that way at some point? Because I know our city's sinking a lot of our main thoroughfares. We have a lot of one-way streets because of this old Spanish grid. And I've talked to our traffic engineer a bit about this, and I think he's sinking them to kind of get cars through and not at like 12 to 15 or to 20, more like 25 to 30. And so,
right, that's more typical.
Yeah. But then I think I've read somewhere that if you can cut back on that but still move throughput if you change like the timing.
Well, cars at lower speeds, you can have more cars in the same space. At higher speeds, cars separate themselves more, and at slower speeds, they're able to get a little bit closer. So that's one thing I've seen. But no, that has been in effect for at least 25 years, probably more. And I think it's to create a pedestrian-friendly downtown.
And that's so interesting, too, because you hear about green wave cycles
right.
in San Francisco, and you've essentially created that
exactly.
already.
Our whole downtown is a green wave for biking. Yeah,
that's awesome.
So I read in the paper yesterday that there's freeway widening.
Right.
Yeah.
And some of the activists are trying to fight it.
Right.
Does your bureau get involved?
Yeah.
So you're worried about the impact if they widen it?
Oh, no. Our bureau fully supports it.
Okay.
It's very complicated. It was a state project that began as a braided ramp interchange and has now gone down to a widening to provide auxiliary lanes and shoulders with improvements at significant surface street improvements and some freeway caps, and also a new bike ped bridge as part of the project. It's also coming with, in a state law, it's coming with the ability to do congestion pricing on the freeways.
Oh.
So not everyone in the agency supports it. And it's generated a lot of controversy, and a lot of the very prominent people in town are strongly opposed to it. I mean, it's about a $450 million project. Maybe half, a little bit more than half, is actually dedicated to the freeway itself. The rest of it is to surface street improvements. But it still has just brought up the question of whether it's appropriate in this day and age to do anything to widen freeways, mm-hmm. and what a loss of big opportunity cost of that funding. So officially my agency supports it. They also see it as kind of the way, we're still in America. People still like to drive cars, and mm-hmm. We're seeing our bike use. The number of people using bikes isn't dropping, but in the last year, or between 2015 and 2016, we saw an influx of about 11,000 new commuters, 87% of whom drove, which is a complete reversal of where we've been. Because between 2000 and 2015 or 2014, we saw about 55,000 new commuters, and only 28% of them were driving commuters. And now in the last year, or the previous year, we saw 11,000, 87% of them drove. Wow. So,
is that because the cost of housing is pushing them farther out?
No, it's because they're affluent. Mm-hmm. Yep. Our data shows that we've got pretty good data across the region, and the wealthier people are, the more they tend to drive. And they're also coming from places probably where it's going to take them a little while to figure out, but there's other ways to get around. And, it's not that hard to drive a car in this town. Congestion has gotten noticeably worse in the last couple of years, but it's still pretty easy compared to a lot of, and probably compared to where they came from, wherever that is.
I'm the timekeeper, Roger, for this group, so maybe any last question for Roger before we say goodbye?
I guess my last request of you is, in short, if you're giving us a pep speech, a city where we are kind of in the curve, hopefully on the curve upwards towards a much better alternative multimodal city. What's your pep speech?
Yeah. So, I think that there is so much more awareness these days about, urban problems, urban ills. There's much greater awareness today than there was two decades ago about climate change, about the relationship between activity and health, about congestion, about air quality and health. And so also there's a lot of examples, not just from Europe, not just Portland, but cities all across the U.S. that are seeing really good advances in bicycle transportation by building really good quality facilities. And you've got an economic argument. When a company like Amazon says, we want to locate our second headquarters in a city that's got really good biking conditions, among other things, this feeds right into what Rahm Emanuel said a number of years ago as mayor of Chicago, that, hey, we're going to build good bike facilities, and we're going to take all of their bikers. He was referring to Seattle and Portland. They're all going to come here. So, creating a bicycle-friendly city just has so many advantages. And I think the message is it's a really good product for cities in many different ways. There's great data and great examples out there. And I think it's about winning hearts and minds. It's about really telling the story of why. Why should we be supporting this? Why bikes? And so I think the argument's gotten a lot easier. And one of the tactics that I like, and it's kind of the NATO tactic, is, do things on a temporary basis. Do tests. Say, hey, we're just going to test this facility. We're going to remove this travel lane and this parking. We're just going to do it as a test for a little while. And, if it doesn't work, we'll take it off. And that's what Vancouver, BC did for a long time. And they've never had to go back and remove anything, and neither have we. And so I think that, that's your in. I don't know if that's a pep talk, but it's more of a strategy talk. But, but I think that there's just a lot more resources available for cities to make the case.
Roger, so inspiring to meet you.
Well, thank you. It's great. Thanks so much for coming. Really nice to meet all of you.
Thank you, Roger. Yeah. Very much.
I see you're on your way to the Mind Right dispensary, so...
Oh, that was in the itinerary.
There was all
Frank's idea.
Recreational is coming to California.
Oh, it's not there yet?
Not there yet.
January.
Yeah. We put you first.
Okay, that's good. I appreciate that. Well, you know, I think the other thing is that we're also spending $1 million of marijuana tax money on safety projects in the city of Portland now. So city council dedicated $1 million of that towards more safety projects. So it's benefiting us in many ways. Yeah. So.
Okay, we're back in the studio and... Again, you're listening to Santa Barbara Cyclist, and I'm your host, Frank Peters, and this is show number, 511? So there's more shows out there. So come by and check out some of the bicycle podcasts that await you there. Well, thanks so much for listening, and good night.